why not take all of me?
Should know the voice right away. It's Frank Sinatra singing All of Me on a radio program from 1949. He was big then, very big. And while his fame ebbed and flowed a bit, he even retired and then unretired, Frank Sinatra, at the time of his death in 1998, was a huge cultural icon in America, and he remains so. Next month marks the 100th anniversary of Sinatra's birth. Today's guest observes the occasion with a book of essays called Sinatra's Century. It is the work of David Layman, who is perhaps best known for his work on the Best American Poetry series of books, which he founded and continues to edit. David also writes his own poetry and cultural criticism and is a member of the faculty of the graduate writing program at New School University in New York. David Layman, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I just learned that Jack Daniels is calling its brand new high-end product Sinatra Century, which is tickles me pink, because my book is called Sinatra's Century, so we're thinking alike.
That's great. So if you don't like the book, you can drink it.
Well, we're hoping to have some sort of gathering where Sinatra's Century, the bourbon, meets Sinatra's Century, the book.
Sounds like a great event.
Yes, and that's a very good recording of All of Me from the late 40s with piano accompaniment. The more famous version is from 1953 with Nelson Riddle, and it is probably the best, but I don't know that people realize how many times he recorded All of Me, and each one is great. It's a perfect song for him.
The CD was a great find, and we have some more stuff to play from it, but it's from a Lucky Strike radio broadcast in 1949 with some cigarette ads and stuff in it that are on there as well. Obviously, you know different versions of Sinatra's songs. Do you consider yourself a bit of a Sinatraologist, David?
Well, I don't know what that means. I've been a fan of his since I was 8 years old and was at a summer camp, and a girl and I were chosen to sing Love and Marriage at the variety show end of summer, and he seems to have punctuated my life. I remember hearing All the Way and Witchcraft on the radio, and I remember when High Hopes was adapted, I was 11 years old, to be the campaign song for JFK. So this person was always present in the background in my life, and I really think he is the greatest of our singers, and I'm a very ardent fan of the Great American Songbook, so I know a lot about him just because I've spent so many hours listening to his songs, reading books about him, and watching his movies. I guess I've become a bit of an expert.
All right. This is not a biography per se. Help us understand what you've done with Sinatra's Century, the book, not the bourbon.
Well, once I had a book contract, I had to figure out how am I going to organize the material and write at length about someone about whom so much has been written. I knew I had some new material, some fresh insights, but I needed a form. And it finally occurred to me that why don't I write the book for publication around the time of his 100th birthday and divide the book into 100 parts? That way I thought of it as a literary form, the century. And once I hit on that idea, everything flowed. I've never had such a good time writing a book, because with 100 parts, each one can have a beginning, middle, and end. You can vary point of view. I could write one section in a second-person point of view, a present tense. Another section could be a playlist of great recordings from the 40s. A third section could be devoted to anagrams derived from the name Sinatra. I mean, I could go all over the map. I could be roughly chronological. You'll get the story of his life in my book, but you will be very entertained because I picked and chose among, you know, the great anecdotes, the great quotations, I think of it as an extended work of literature. creative nonfiction, I guess they're calling it.
And no one of the essays is terribly long, I should point out. There are 100 of them. It is Sinatra's Century. One of them, you focus on the playing of New York at Yankees games. I have to admit to being a Mets fan, so I don't get to see many Yankees games. Do they play the Sinatra New York at every Yankee home game?
Yes. For a time, they played the Sinatra version after a win by the Yankees, and the Liza Minnelli version after a loss. But Liza was not happy with the implication.
I can imagine.
She complained, and now, win or lose, you hear Sinatra after the game. And there have been occasions when the Yankees, well, in particular in 1996, the Yankees came from a 2-0 deficit in games with the Atlanta Braves, and no one expected them to win that World Series, let alone to launch a dynasty. It was Joe Torre's first year as manager. And they came back and won 4 straight. And after the game, the winning game at Yankee Stadium, the entire crowd sang along with Sinatra. And that was very memorable. Mets games are followed by Meet the Mets, which is a jingle that was created in the early 60s.
I know. Considering the quality of the franchise, too, it's often been turned into Beat the Mets.
Well, we had a pretty good year this year. We got to the World Series.
Absolutely. It was good stuff. As we head into this first break, let's hear from Frank Sinatra from that Lucky Strike program from 1949, singing Don't You Go Away Mad. We'll come back and talk more with David Layman about Sinatra's Century in just a moment.
Our kind's a dime a dozen. That's not the kind I want. Whoever dreamed that's your cousin would wander into that restaurant. I understand that you're quite upset. What do you say that you forgive and forget? Come and kiss me just to show that you're glad. Baby, baby, don't you go away mad.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart.
Frank Sinatra singing My Funny Valentine here on the Jefferson Exchange in honor of our guest today, David Layman, who's the author of a book called Sinatra's Century. 100 Notes on the Man and His World, not a biography per se, 100 essays from a number of different points in Sinatra's life and from a number of different points of view. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we mark the career of Francis Albert Sinatra. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. David, you say Sinatra figures in 3 aesthetic realms: singer, movie actor, and movie star. What's the difference between movie actor and movie star?
May I start by saying that what you just played, My Funny Valentine, is, I think, the best version of My Funny Valentine that anyone has done. I mean, that is superb, great cut. I suppose the distinction between movie actor and movie star is that I think he was a very skillful actor at least half a dozen movies, and also a very fine performer in movie musicals. But he was also a star, that is, someone who transcended the job of being an actor. For one thing, he became very powerful, a kind of producer, a controller of events. And for another, he had a personality that attracted attention that far transcended the ordinary. I mean, Frank Sinatra made news by, snapping at a head waiter. The tabloids loved him. Sometimes they loved making mockery or merriment at his expense. But they loved him. He was a newsmaker. In fact, from the time he was 25, I don't think that he had a normal life. I don't think he knew what it was like to be an ordinary human being, because he needed to be ushered by bodyguards or to have police protection to know the back exit of any hall. And the girls in the 1940s behaved with Sinatra as they would later with Elvis Presley. And it was sort of the first instance of that phenomenon of teenage girls going crazy over a male performer. And then he, 10 years later, became a kind of heroic male model for American men in a time of evolving values. So he's a figure, a phenomenon, in addition to being a singer and an actor.
And there's something about Frank Sinatra that made him transcending of generations, and I'm still trying to figure out why people who probably would not listen to the music of certain writers or even certain genres would listen to Frank Sinatra versions.
Well, first of all, he's gifted with having the greatest voice to begin with. Certainly you can hear it in the 1940s. He's got the best equipment of anyone. And then you add to it his interpretive capability. He knows how to interpret a lyric to such an extent that he makes it sound as if it's a song written by, let's say, Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer is a chapter of his own autobiography. This is quite an artistic triumph. And he has the best musicians playing. He has a genius of a musical arranger. And the song is written by Rodgers and Hart, if it's Where or When, or by Arlen and Mercer, if it's One for My Baby and One More for the Road. Cole Porter, I've Got You Under My Skin. So you've got a terrific fusion of genius in the songwriters, in the singer, and in the musicians, and the arranger who's writing the music for 28 parts.
And it always helps to have somebody who sounds like a regular guy. So I want to come back to that Lucky Strike CD I mentioned, and you'll hear the stuff right at the very beginning. So, Megan, this is the first cut on that Lucky Strike CD, The Best Things in Life Are Free. You don't have it in there anymore? Okay, never mind. Let me hear something else then, because this is something you referenced in the book. And it's a song I love anyway, but I didn't realize that Sinatra had sung. And it's If I Loved You from Carousel. And it's a particular Frank Sinatra version. So let's hear that right now.
Oh, great.
Try to say all I'd want you to know. If I loved you, words wouldn't come in an easy way. Round in circles I'd go. Longing to tell you, but afraid and shy, I'd let my golden chances pass me by.
Frank Sinatra singing If I Loved You, the song from Carousel, which is something that David Lehman, our guest, had pointed up as a particularly good version of the song in his book Sinatra's Century, as we talked to David here on the Jefferson Exchange. You know, I'm struck the more I listen to Frank Sinatra, and I was not a big appreciator. I mean, I grew up with the Beatles, I was 5 years old and the Beatles came to the country and all that. But the more I listen to, the more I realize that all the contradictions of Frank Sinatra, which you point out very well in the book as well. This is the tough guy who hung out with mobsters, but he's singing so tenderly here as well.
Yes, that's the essential paradox in the life and personality of Frank Sinatra. You know, If I Loved You from Carousel, a beautiful choice because Sinatra can sing a tender love ballad beautifully with a great show of sincerity and passion. And women used to say they felt that he was singing to each one alone, you know. And if a man heard that, you know, he would identify with the voice because he would like to seduce the beloved in just that way. I think of Dean Martin, who's a genius at comedy, and Sinatra's very bad at it, but Dean Martin could never sing If I Loved You in quite this way, because Dean Martin was more of an ironist. But Sinatra really believes this stuff. When he sings the House I Live In, which begins, what is America to me? He means it. When he sings America the Beautiful, he is a passionate lover of this country. If I Loved You, I mean, he loved that score of Carousel. He was going to play Billy Bigelow in the movie, but in his manner, he walked out of the set the first day. And that was the other side of the personality that you referred to. He was his own man. He was very obstinate. He held a grudge. While he could be incredibly generous, incredibly charitable, and a wonderful friend, great loyalty, if he disliked you or if you crossed him, he was not forgiving. He was this larger-than-life character who never doubted himself, it seems, for a minute, not that you could see. So all this makes him quite fascinating. But, of course, it all builds on the actual singing accomplishments. And this guy could do it on radio. He could do it in the movies. He could do it in the recording studio. He could do it in live concerts and nightclubs. And he loved to sing, you know. He would say, "May you live to be 100, and may the last voice you hear be mine."
Well, he didn't quite live to be 100, but his 100th birthday anniversary is coming up. Sinatra's Century is the book by David Lehman commemorating that. It's 100 Notes on the Man and His World. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your Sinatra memories or questions for David. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Good morning, David. Well, David, no biographer would truly appreciate Frank Sinatra without the help of his Rat Pack. Could you please speak to Frank Sinatra and his interaction with the Rat Pack? I know a lot of people that are listening here in the audience don't even know what I'm talking about, but perhaps you could compare and contrast Frank Sinatra's relationship with the Rat Pack, and I would really appreciate that, Jeffrey. So I'll just take the response off the phone, if I can.
All right, thanks, James. Here we get to Dean Martin and Company again. The Rat Pack.
Well, Frank Sinatra is at the center of and the acknowledged leader of a bunch of millionaire entertainers who really dig each other's company. And get together in Las Vegas in 1959 to shoot a movie called Ocean's 11 with Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, Sammy Davis Jr., Joey Bishop, Richard Conte, a bunch of Angie Dickinson. These people really like each other's company, and the guys are shooting the movie by day and doing nightclub at night in the casinos. So it's, and JFK becomes friendly with Sinatra because Peter Lawford is John F. Kennedy's brother-in-law. And he comes out frequently in 1959 and 1960 to Las Vegas to hang with Frank and the chums. And they go on to make other movies together, and Sinatra loves Dean Martin. I mean, he just thinks that he's one of the greatest guys. And and also he's very fond and supportive of Sammy Davis. And there become the sort of nucleus of a group that did a lot of nightclub entertaining in Las Vegas, in Chicago, in St. Louis. They did benefit concerts. They had a wonderful time. You can get CDs. They're very politically incorrect in their humor. But it's a quite an interesting group because you have two Italian-Americans. You have a Jewish-American and Joey Bishop. You have Sammy Davis, a black man who's also a Jew. You have and Peter Lawford, until he's in the doghouse, is a sort of British patrician. So it's an interesting, eclectic assemblage of guys who really enjoy themselves. This is the early 1960s, the era of astronauts and of JFK and Johnny Carson, and they embody cool. And swing music is still going strong, though rock and roll has supplanted it in the popular culture. But you still have great, great swing musicians. And so, you know, Dean Martin will sing a song like Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime, and it climbs to number one in 1964, despite the domination by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
I didn't realize it hit the top of the charts that late. That's good to know. The Rat Pack was, you know, these cool and semi tough guys you didn't want to mess with. But in real life, Frank Sinatra's gravitation toward mobsters, was that about power or ethnicity or something else?
Well, in Italian American neighborhoods in the 1920s, when Sinatra was a boy, you were a very discriminated against minority group. And in Hoboken, where Frank grew up, his neighborhood was Italian and Jewish. In such a neighborhood, the crime bosses, the mobsters, the head mafiosi, actually are sort of community heroes in a way. They organize things. It's romanticized in The Godfather Part One, but there's a real element of truth to it. And you grow up in that climate, and you have a certain respect, to use a very pertinent word in the mob world, for these powerful men who have a real ethic. Sinatra was, very aware of this, and in fact, it was mutual. The Fischetti brothers and a whole bunch of other people affiliated with the mafia are always taking an interest in Frank's life, and he was photographed with Lucky Luciano in Havana, Cuba, in the late 40s. So, there's a reason that Francis Ford Coppola and Mario Puzo patterned the life of the character Johnny Fontaine in The Godfather after Sinatra. I mean, they took many liberties, but behind the character of Johnny Fontaine is the life and legend of Frank Sinatra.
We have another question here from Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Layman, the author of Sinatra's Century.
Hi. Does your book talk about, I always thought that Ava Gardner was the one true love of his?
Oh,
yes.
She is definitely mentioned in here. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yes. I think he was crazy about her as about no other. To quote an observer at the time, he had, quote, hot nuts for her. She was the most beautiful woman in the world, arguably, almost certainly the most beautiful brunette, and was advertised by her studio as like a human animal, radiating sexuality. She was also as wild as Sinatra. Unlike most of the women Sinatra was involved with, she was not that eager to stay loyal to him. I mean, she would have flings with bullfighters with rival movie actors, and he was crushed by that. And it was that it came at a time in his career when his career was foundering, that he left his wife for Ava Gardner, which did not help him, his image with the world. And it was at the same time that he lost both his movie contract and his recording studios. He's really at low ebb when he's involved with Ava, but they are passionate about each other. They can't stop fighting. And then they have the greatest makeup sex in the entire world. And she is quite a character. She has a great line about Frank. I don't think I can mention it on the phone, though. I mean, on the radio. Perhaps I can paraphrase it. John Ford, the director, said to Ava Gardner, what do you see in that 120-pound runt? And she said, well, Frank may weigh 120 pounds, but 10 of them are pure.
Uh-huh. Okay. On that note, let's hear Frank Sinatra from 1949 on that Lucky Strike show we talked about as we head to a break. Back in just a moment.
It's Light Up Time, presented by Lucky Strike, starring Frank Sinatra, Dorothy Kirsten, and Ziggy Elman in the orchestra.
This is FS for LS, Frank Sinatra for Lucky Strike. And I trust that if our Thanksgiving show turns...
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me.
Sinatra singing Under My Skin here on the Jefferson Exchange. Frank Sinatra's our focus today because we're talking to David Layman about the upcoming 100th anniversary of Frank Sinatra's birth. He's written a book called Sinatra's Century, 100 Notes on the Man and His World. Now we're having some fun here listening to Frank and talking to David about him. You can join the conversation on the Exchange with your memories of Frank Sinatra and ways in which he might have gotten you through tough times in your life. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You write, David, that in Sinatra's career you see the cultural history of America in the 20th century. Not too strong a comment?
No, not at all. But once again, I want to start by just commenting on the record you're playing. I've Got You Under My Skin is, in the opinion of many of us, Sinatra's greatest single up-tempo song. It's on an album called Songs for Swinging Lovers from 1956. And it is masterly. It's not an easy song to sing. And this song really epitomizes what swing means. I remember when I heard it when I was, I think, 15, it came as an epiphany to me. The sort of epiphany I think a lot of Sinatra fans go through when they hear real work of genius in the presentation of a song. But now we should really attend to your pertinent question.
Which was about the Sinatra representing the cultural history of of America in the 20th century.
Well, don't you think there's a lot of truth to that?
He certainly spans a lot of eras when you think about the fact that he was born during World War One, was an idol by World War Two, and was still, I mean, we're still talking about him now, 100 years after his birth.
Yes, that's right. He also seemed to embody a kind of arc of American opinion. In his early days, Frank was a great FDR Democrat, and also he made a name for himself by promoting tolerance and fighting bigotry, and he won an award from the Academy in 1945 for his work on this film, The House I Live In, which is against anti-Semitism. It's a brilliant short, and he sings this wonderful song, which he later would sing in the White House of John F. Kennedy, in the White House of Richard Nixon, and in the White House of Ronald Reagan. So here's somebody who's a Roosevelt Democrat who winds up being a Reagan Republican, and some way that's a curve that an entire generation can relate to. But it's an interesting itinerary, of which the highest point, I guess, is the intense relations between Sinatra and the Kennedys. which makes fascinating reading. The other thing about Sinatra is he had an incredible talent for friendship. So if you study his life, you intersect with Marilyn Monroe, with Leonard Bernstein, with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, with Phil Silvers, with Ira Gershwin, with presidents of the United States, and singers, musicians, band leaders of great renown. Every place you turn, there are people who have opinions about him or have very deep feelings about him. Judy Collins is not a singer you would associate with Frank Sinatra, but she attributes to Frank her understanding of the art of phrasing. And that's a strong tribute.
Something about Frank Sinatra's training. I know from reading Kitty Kelly's biography that he disclaimed having much in the way of training, but he didn't come by this all naturally, did he? I mean, was there some idol at least he tried to sing like or something?
Well, he took voice lessons. He spent a lot of time in practice vocalizing. He also swam underwater for lengthy periods to develop his capacity for breathing and holding a note for, you know, what seems an impossible length of time. He did have a natural voice. Bing Crosby was the inspiring figure. He thought he could do what Crosby was doing, but he also was smart enough to think that it would be wiser to avoid singing in the manner of Bing. Most of the baritones of the 40s sang in the Bing manner, and Sinatra not. Sinatra was more bel canto, and it was just a smart choice. I mean, he really does not sound like Bing Crosby.
You describe the difference as the crooner and the groaner.
Well, the groaner was a nickname that Bing had because Bing's greatest strength was the depth of his baritone, which was unbelievable. Only Dick Haymes could rival it, and he's a wonderful singer. But that got him that nickname, the groaner. And Sinatra was more of a crooner in the sense that he really did seduce the ears of the female listener. Something that Bing wasn't aiming to do and didn't do.
Let's take a call here. We have John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Layman, the author of Sinatra's Century.
Hi. So he was in, I think, one of the most famous movies, From Here to Eternity. Tell us a little bit about how he got that role and what kind of, how did critics see him? I think he maybe even got an award for it. I don't remember. But anyway, it's, you know, for the listeners who don't know, the movie was made probably in, I think, the late 50s, and it's about Pearl Harbor.
All right. From Here to Eternity. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster, was that who was in it?
Yes, and Montgomery Clift. And Sinatra and Montgomery Clift got very close during the filming. He did win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, and that sort of was the moment when his comeback from the depths of despair and career disaster began, because he got the Academy Award, and the same year, 1954, I believe, he also had the number one hit, Young at Heart, from another movie, one where he co-starred with Doris Day. The importance of From Here to Eternity in Sinatra's career can't be overstated, because his career was as volatile as his personality, and he had reached the absolute nadir, the lowest possible point, and From Here to Eternity was what triggered the greatest comeback in, you know, entertainment history, as it was often described. Now, how did he get the role is a matter of great controversy. We have many explanations. According to one, it was Ava who got him the role by pleading with the studio boss, Harry Cohn, and his wife, Joan. That's one thing that has been advanced, and another is that the mob got him the part. Now, it's that version that is melodramatized in The Godfather Part 1 in an extremely absorbing and unforgettable way. And there are to this day people who think that he got the part because a horse's head was deposited in a film director's bed. Now, that certainly didn't happen. But how did he get that part is something that is as in much in dispute as who killed JFK.
You know, it's a movie about the war, and we haven't talked yet about the fact that that Sinatra's first peak, anyway, with the Bobby Soxers was during the Second World War, and it's probably the time to ask then why he was not in the military during that time.
Well, he had, he was 4F. He had something wrong with an eardrum, and it was he was considered a military risk. So he couldn't serve. Now, this made right-wing columnists irate at his success. They were, you know, resentful of this young pup anyway. But he became a substitute for the men abroad. The girls were had fewer fellows to choose from, and some of them carried on vicariously with Sinatra. They organized fan clubs, the Swoonatra fans, and so on. But it's sort of ironic that he did not serve in the military, and yet his great movie roles in From Here to Eternity and also The Manchurian Candidate and Von Ryan's Express, for that matter, and Some Came Running, he is either in an Army uniform or he has just been released from the military. And it goes back even to his being a sailor with Gene Kelly in Anchors Away and in On the Town. It's a sort of curious paradox. Someone who did not serve in the military becomes a perfect actor to embody a GI during the Second World War. And I think that's probably because Frank always sounds like a guy you knew in Brooklyn or Hoboken.
Mm-hmm. Which is the amazing thing. He still manages to pull off the regular guy stuff, and I think to some degree an underdog kind of view of things. I mean, you can't have a comeback unless you've been down. And yet this is a guy who was really, as you point out, so much permeated in American culture in the 20th century. It's hard to think of him as an underdog in that sense.
True. And From Here to Eternity, he is so skinny. He's so lean. He weighs about 120 pounds, or maybe 130 by this time. And he looks like the victim. In fact, he has to go to the stockade and is punished by a bigoted, very large sergeant played by Ernest Borgnine. And Sinatra is the little guy in this movie. And in fact, he dies in the movie. It might be thought that for some American heroes, they need to die first on screen before the people will make much of him. Luckily, it's only on screen.
When I think about the legacies of great musical figures, of which Frank Sinatra certainly seems to be at this moment, I think about, you know, composers from 200, 300 years ago who may be known well to us now because we've readopted them, but you know, within a generation or two after their own lives ended, they were not terribly well known. What do you see Frank Sinatra's legacy being once the people who remember the 20th century move on will be?
He will be listened to for a long, long time because of the quality of his work, and also because one of the great cultural legacies of the 20th century is the American, classic American popular songs, as written by the Gershwins and by Rodgers and Hart, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen, Leonard Bernstein, Johnny Mercer, Dorothy Fields, on and on and on. And so these movies with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, with Gene Kelly and Sid Charisse or Leslie Caron, these musical shows, Oklahoma and Carousel and Kiss Me Kate and Guys and Dolls, or movies made from them, will be revived. survived. We're lucky we have so much on tape, both audio and visual. Just as opera of the 19th century has an extremely loyal, even passionate following in the United States today, so this music and its greatest interpreters will be listened to 100 years from now, probably longer than that.
So on that note, let us go out listening to Frank Sinatra's The Way You Look Tonight. And I want to thank David Lehman for joining us. The book is called Sinatra's Century, 100 Notes on the Man and His World. David, thank you.
What a pleasure.
All right, take care. The Exchange is produced by Emily Curitan. Megan Mercier is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Enjoy Frank Sinatra. Enjoy your day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
I love you just the way you look tonight. Touches my foolish heart. Lovely, don't you ever change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight. Just the way